Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay!
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone. Try to remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause.
I'm going to wrestle some papers.
Okay.
Now 1, 2, 3. Okay.
Hey, I'm KJ Dell'Antonia, and this is Hashtag Am Writing, the weekly podcast about writing all the things, short, long, fiction, nonfiction, pitches, proposals, essays. That's a hint. We are the weekly podcast about sitting down and getting the work done.
And I'm Jenny Nash. I am the newest co-host here at the Hashtag Am Writing podcast. I'm the founder and CEO of Author Accelerator, a company on a mission to lead the emerging book coach industry. And I'm the author of 12 books in 3 genres, including actually a book of essays. Another hint.
Excellent. I have written many essays, but never put them in a book. I am the author of 3 novels, The Chicken Sisters, In Her Boots, and Playing the Witch Card, as well as a book about parenting. What is that one called? I don't know. How to Be a Happier Parent. It is not fiction. And more importantly, with us today is our guest, Amy Wilson. Amy is a podcast host of a podcast I hope that you have at least checked out if you are a parent. It is called What Fresh Hell, which is a brilliant title for a parenting podcast. Amy is also the author of more than one book, but we are going to talk today specifically about her book, her most recent book of essays, Happy to Help, Adventures of a People Pleaser, which we helped to title and we really adore. Right. So thanks for hanging out with us, Amy.
Thank you. It's very exciting to be a guest. I'm a longtime listener, first time guest.
Well, we didn't do any preparation because, I mean, you're happy to help. So could you just, you know, take it away?
Okay. No problem.
Kidding.
I'll take it from here.
I'm a little out of practice, kids. Or maybe I'm just a little goofy today, but we are excited to have Amy with us. She has done something that is really difficult, which is to publish a book of essays. I feel like our podcast has created the illusion that it isn't difficult because we have a number of friends who have pulled it off, but honestly, it really is, because I think there is a feeling that people don't read books of essays, that books of essays are almost too easy. I don't know. Why do you kids think that it, I mean, because it really is a tough sell. Why do you think that it's a tough sell?
You know, I wasn't aware that it was a tough sell until like this week. There was an article in some trade, The Walrus or something like that, like essays don't work and publishers don't want to publish them. And now you tell me. I didn't know that.
I did not mean that people don't buy and read them, because they absolutely do. I mean, that's the thing. There are a lot of really uber popular books of essays out there. And yet the conventional wisdom, and I think it's true, I mean, you tell us, Jenny, because you work with more writers, the conventional wisdom, at least, is that it's tough to get a book of essays off the ground in terms of finding a publisher.
Oh, I think it's absolutely true. And I know exactly why. And then it will lead to what Amy did that is so brilliant. So we will wind around that. But it's so easy to think that you can write a bunch of things and put them together and they're going to be a book. And particularly people think that in the age, I guess we're the post-blog age, but you know, the age of blogs and Substacks and newsletters, it's like, oh, I could just pull a bunch of things I've already written and they're sort of about the same thing or they're in the same thematic arena and pull them together and that's going to make for a good book. And it usually doesn't. And we have the example of famous people essays who do get to do that, because, you know, if Tina Fey writes a bunch of things about her life, we all want to read them because she's Tina Fey. But for regular people, regular writers, it is the act of making that form into a cohesive whole is what's so hard. And that, it really struck me in reading your book, Amy, that you you had absolutely done that. These do not feel like blogs. They feel there's a core, a spine to them. They're telling a story. They're moving us through an idea that you're circling around and talking about. And the experience of reading them, there's a propulsive energy and narrative drive to them that you just don't see when people don't do it well. So I think the reason publishers say they don't like them and people say they're hard to sell, it's because it's hard to do it well. And if you do it well, sure, it's easier. And people love reading this form. So, but doing it well is what's hard. So I would love to ask you how you feel about that aspect of your work. Did you feel, because you write all the things too, did you feel that sense of this making something that's bigger than a bunch of small things?
Yes, truly, thanks to you, Jenny, and your Blueprint book. That I think that's why I'm delighted to hear you say this, because it's your work that helped me create the spine first. And then everything changes along the way. Of course, there's lots of changes. This patient had half its organs out on the operating table and put back in different places. But I knew my beginning point and my end point. I knew why I was writing it. I knew that the character was going to have a process of learning about, am I happy to help? And what does that even mean? And what if I stop? And what if I do things differently? And that the lessons that she learned had to come in a certain order that I would explore that would not necessarily be chronological. But that, so, and you're not aware of it as a reader, but when it's done well, right, you're moving through it and something's happening along the way, the character's changing. I was constantly aware of the me now, I forget what you call it, Jenny, but like the me character, the me as character who is not you now, and the two awarenesses and how to weave those in and out. And I did a lot of work very early setting that up. And I think that really made the difference.
Well, I didn't expect that to be the answer, but
it's true. It's really true.
Thank you. There is a moment in the book that I felt like a punch to my gut reading this, and it illustrates exactly what you're talking about, where you're looking back at a diary that you kept as a teenager, and you're looking at it from the perspective of this person who is you now, who understands this idea of always being happy to help, always being the one to say yes, always being the person who can do all the things. And you use this sort of conceit of looking at your diary, but your actual words of the diary. And it, when I say it read as a reader, it felt like a punch to the gut. It was just sort of like, like, oh, right? That we're formed in those years, our early years, who we are as adults. We're it's like that crucible we're formed in, and we don't even know the forces that are forming us. And you're looking at that, at what you left out of those pages, and that really struck a chord with me. And what's brilliant about it is that perspective shift of, it's not just, oh, here's what I was like as a teenager, or here's the water I swam in as a teenager. It's like, no, who I am today in this spot, looking back at that young girl and what she didn't know and what she didn't see and what she was swallowing whole, that it's that makes the form so powerful.
Maggie Smith just said something about, she called it like a palimpsest, I think, and that you needed to have both of those narrators. You needed to have the awareness of what the author now is saying versus what the character is saying. And I thought, well, I think I got that across without knowing to call it that.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Because otherwise it's just, here's some stuff that happened, right?
Yes, which we sometimes we want if there's a dramatic thing in a life, but you're, oh, I'm sorry, I don't know why.
It's kind of probably this.
I just, the care with which you crafted these pieces is so on display. And but that was the moment where I really saw it. KJ, I saw you writing something down. What were you writing?
Oh, I was actually pulling out Amy's book, because the essay that you're talking about you could almost call it a chapter, because what we haven't directly said to the listener is that Happy to Help, Adventures of a People Pleaser is a book of essays about being a people pleaser. Okay, right. Surprise. This is stunning. But what we're circling around here is that the fact that Amy was able to see this one element of her personality as something fairly common and universal enough that people would be interested in it, but also to write about it in such specificity is what is making the book work. So the challenge, say you're me and you've written 700 short essays in your life as a part of the New York Times, which I don't own and I can't turn into a, anyway, I don't want to, but they don't circle around a particular theme. Or maybe if they do, you know, maybe I could find something and I could pull them out, but you can't just pull out, you know, 7 or 15 blog entries and tape them together and call it a book. It's the fact that there's this theme. And as Amy said, this arc of change for the character who is her in the past, who becomes her at the end of the book, who is still not necessarily her at the present, that makes this work. And I'm just looking again at the chapter in which Amy pulls out entries from her eighth grade diary, the only year she kept one. And she reads through it and she's like, okay, this is what I wrote. And this is what actually happened. And they're two totally, not totally different things, but I mean, sometimes they are totally different in that, you know, she's like promising herself in the style of Young Miss magazine that she's only going to eat a certain amount of this school candy that she has purchased. And she's like, I remember those candies. I ate the whole box in 2 days. And then, you know, I remember this boy and I actually never talked to him. Or then at some point she says in the diary as an eighth grader, I've decided to make another promise. Only write happy things in here.
Right.
Because that's right. The point of a journal, right?
Because that's the point. And my intention was to create a future self who only had the good parts, who would only remember the good stuff. You can curate yourself as you go along, even for yourself, because nobody was going to read this except me. Although I did sometimes write very grandly in the idea that, you know, my diary.
I think any eighth grader who's read Diary of Anne Frank without, yes, you know, certainly without in any way expecting to or hoping to have the same fate can't right. help but write as though someone is going to read it.
Your life is so important and everything that happens every day is so important. And this started as a play that I did many years ago with a dear friend of mine, Julie Kramer, and she's a director. And when we were both just getting started in New York, she knew me since I was 14. She didn't know me in eighth grade, but she knew me in ninth grade. And so we worked on this together. And her thing when we started working on it was that she wanted the show to move from, aren't eighth grade diaries stupid, to, no, they're not. They're not. You're like, wasn't this dumb when this happened? No, it wasn't dumb. There was something else going on. And so when we worked on this together, gosh, it was 20 years ago now, it showed me that there was something important in there worth exploring. And that I think is true for, I hope, the book, that all of this is worth exploring. Like, if you're a people pleaser, you came by it honestly because everybody told you to be one from the time that you can remember. And so here's what happens when that happens.
And also, it's not enough to just be like, well, and now I will stop.
Yeah, so just don't do it. Right, right.
Yeah, which is the only advice people give you. Well, you know, you should probably start thinking of yourself more and self-care. And I mean, and this is all in the book. But, you know, you sort of also do that meta thing of, if you're a people pleaser, you need to think about, you know, why you why you've become this way. And I guess I'm not talking about being a people pleaser. I'm talking about, right, you know, creating a book around this element of your personality that so many people share. And, you know, one of the things that makes it work is that it is not a, it's not just a funny exploration of a quirk. And it's also not by any means a, you know, a hectoring suggestion to people still suffering from this particular personality trait from you on high who have now changed yourself to change themselves. It's an exploration of who you are through this one particular trait that becomes an invitation to the reader to explore who they are, either through this trait, or perhaps they don't share this, but they have other things that are similar. But that's what makes it work.
Thank you. I mean, that's very much my hope, right? That you believe the things that people tell you that you are, and you fold those into your sense of self, particularly if it happens starting when you're a child. And I have been told that I was a happy helper for so long that it's not like I wasn't. There isn't this current of resentment running through the whole thing. And then one day I flip the table and stop lying. Like that doesn't happen, because that's not even true. I do like helping people. It is part of my personality and something I draw self-esteem from. But it gets hard to tangle out if that was really you or if you just rose to the occasion.
Well, one of the things you also do in this book, which is difficult to pull off well, is there's a lot of, well, KJ talked about the fact that you're exploring this idea, and it's not just your own experience, you're exploring it as an idea. It's like an exploration of a concept. And what you do is you bring in a lot of references from the culture, both the culture of the adventures you're writing about throughout your life. You know, we mentioned the Young Miss magazine, but there's also a book that was a bestseller back in the day called Meditations for Women Who Do Too Much, which, yeah, I absolutely bought and owned. And there's the I Hate to Cook book, and there's studies that were done and ideas that were filtering through the newspapers or the news shows or the culture or people who were in the spotlight at the time. And so you're talking about this idea of how do you become this thing, not just in your own body or your own family or your own life, but in a wider context. So I would love to ask about how you thought about that kind of reference and how much of it to bring in. How much research did you do around those things? Was it just remembered things about these elements, or did you dig into them?
I really did dig in, and it was a major, this book went through a long editing process, and I think at its center, there's funny stories, and then it feels like a TED Talk, was the first draft feedback. And so, and my developmental editor, her name is Kathleen Robinson. She was amazing. And she helped me sort of tease out, okay, there's some of the research was, I know what Jess would call, like, you are the expert. I went in a book and found, like, yes, it really is true that first daughters are more likely to be this, but maybe I don't need to quote that in the book. Maybe knowing that that's true, I went and checked that I was right about this idea I had. Now I can just assert it because I know it. I don't need to quote back up everything I say. I can find my own expert voice. And some of it could go. And some of it needed to be rewritten with this. It made me wonder, you know, like that old Sex and the City thing, you know, that Sarah Jessica Parker's character, mm-hmm, was like, huh. And it made me wonder, I couldn't help but wonder that was a thread that we had to bring into it. And I think that really helped that, this is, you know, Nancy Drew is going to figure out, like, what is it about multitasking? And is it really true? And make it sort of something that was happening during the narrative, as opposed to, a sidebar of research. Mm. And I think we got there, but it took a long time to find that, because I wanted the book to be both. I didn't want it to be LOL essays for the back of the toilet. And my publisher very much didn't want it to be a researched nonfiction book that wasn't what they had bought. So trying to thread that needle it was worth the work, but it was a lot of work.
Do you think you spent more work in editing on that aspect or on the aspect of ordering the pieces?
The order changed many, many times. I was actually looking at that for today. I've pulled up my old Inside outline and it went through like 6 or 7 permutations. And it was so hard because there are some essays that are very funny. There are some that are serious and there's some in eighth grade and there are some that are from last year. And how do you give it a shape? But so that required a lot of work, but that it felt like a puzzle, but they were all there. Like it had to work somehow. It's a seating arrangement, right? And you will get there. Whereas I think you need to unite the two voices of this book, even if I agreed with that note, was like, oh boy, what am I going to do now? That took me a long time.
Unite the researched based you and yes. The anecdotal you.
Yes. Okay. Yes. And they wanted it to be more light and I wanted to keep in some stuff that was more serious. Okay. So how do you add a little bit that's light and how do you thread that throughout? Mary Carr says something about in memoir that you have to use humor to help a reader over the dark places. So I tried that very hard in the dark place, like make sure there's plenty of funny and plenty of relatable and plenty of like, it's going to be okay, right? Like here mm-hmm. I am now, writer, telling you the dum-dum in the moment doesn't know that, you know, she's overthinking this. And the other thing that I tried really hard to bring in that kept it all, I think, a little lighter was Wendy Ahrens talks about how, can I curse on this podcast? Is this a clean-rated podcast?
Usually it is.
All right. Well,
If you need one, it doesn't seem to notice.
Wendy Ahrens says that when you're writing humor, in order to prevent from punching down, you're the a-hole. The narrator, is always the a-hole. So if, you know, I have a doctor in this book who's being very imperious and telling me I don't know anything, I'm the a-hole because I'm the one that's like, oh, okay, yes, yes. So then I'll ignore this, you know, disease creeping up my arm because you tell me it's nothing, right? The jerk is you. And if you can always make it that, then that keeps the book funny and from punching down and getting too complainy. So I forget what question I was even supposed to answer, but those two things really helped me, I think, bring in enough humor. Because I didn't want it to be like, oh my gosh, here's some crazy things I did. And like, I'm such a people pleaser. I need to stop, right? Like, I don't think that that's the answer or fair mm-hmm. or useful. So I didn't want to leave it there.
So now I'm intrigued by how you used the inside outline to structure this. Can you, as listeners are listening to this, many people are getting started on their own blueprints for a book. And I've never really thought about using the inside outline to structure a book of essays. So I would love to hear what that looked like even through the process.
I was looking at it. I mean, I was thinking I was writing a memoir. And actually, Jenny, at the time, I used Blueprint for a nonfiction book because Blueprint for a memoir wasn't out yet, although it was certainly very useful. And I worked with a coach. I worked with one of Jenny's coaches on it in the first draft, and it helped me okay, what's the lesson that the me now learns? I knew and I always kept that the book would start with me in eighth grade and end with my daughter in eighth grade, getting the same lessons and reacting to them differently, I hoped. So once I had the beginning and the end, then it was like, what was this person going to learn all along the way? And in each essay, there's sort of a different, at least thematically, there's a different piece of advice that the character, me, is really trying to adhere to. Look on the bright side, or don't give up hope, or whatever. You know, all these different cat hanging by a thread, you know, yeah. Hang in there, baby things that we hear. Because I really was, I was really trying to live by the advice people gave me that I could fix the problems in my life by just hanging in there and working a little harder. And so I knew that that was going to be the theme for each one. And those are the essay titles. Yeah, that was my editor at Zibby Books, Kathleen Harris. That was sort of a 11th hour thing. She's like, I had an idea. What if the titles of the essay are the bad advice. I'm like, yes.
Yeah, there are all these cliches.
Yes.
You know, the only one you can change is you. Never give up. First do no harm.
Yeah.
No, I'm sorry. First do no harm. We're all in this together.
Yeah. And there were all different ways.
And then the essays are
how you go astray by trying to do that thing. You follow that advice. And
so in terms of ordering, the question that I always love is, you use the term seating chart. It's a seating chart, which I now I'm going to use all the time because yes, it is. But what's interesting is, how do you know when you've got it, right? These pieces could be in any sort of order, even within the container of the eighth grade to eighth grade shape. How do you know when it feels, because the experience of reading them is that they're where they need to be. They're in the, you don't read them and think, oh, wait, I wish she'd told me this earlier, or wait, why is that here? There's none of that. It's a story. You're in the narrative of it. When you were making these different seating charts, did you feel like, oh, you know, something's not right there? Oh, I don't, like, was it a gut instinct, or was it thinking more intellectually about how they connected?
It was using spreadsheets, and I even would sort of color code. I used for myself like 8 different colors, that this one is like a little sad, or this one's really heavy, or this one's medical. So you can't have 2 medical next to each other. You can't have 2 about the same. It can't get chronological for more than 2 or 3 in a row. And I created this whole Beautiful Mind spreadsheet of color coding, and also watched for what the lesson that the me character learned in the chapter. What is your thing that you say? It's like, because this, then that.
Yeah, because of this, instead of, and then this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened.
Because of this, right. So I know, like, okay, I knew, because I started from the beginning, the lesson that the character has learned at the end of this essay is, don't wait for people to ask if you need help or whatever. I'm making that up. And she can't have learned that yet because this other one is still coming. And I think that I knew, I could see the trees. So I knew where those problems would be. And I just read the audiobook a couple of weeks ago. And it's a funny experience, right? To re-engage with your book as a done thing, and it's too late to change anything. And I was really relieved and happy that I felt like it did flow. As well as it could have. You know, I'm a perfectionist, I guess. It'll never be perfect, but it worked. And I think it was because I knew what I was watching for because of the outline.
How much of what's in here does come from stuff you had already written?
Very little bit. So the eighth grade diary is this theater piece I did with my friend 20 years ago. The piece that is called First Do No Harm, a very early version of this I did on stage at Listen to Your Mother, which was it's kind of like the moth in honor of Mother's Day. It's still being done around the country. So I wrote a piece for that. And then with major edits, and Emig helped me edit it, and it was in the Listen to Your Mother anthology. But if you looked at that essay now, I mean, it would be interesting for like a writing class, right? To compare the two essays. And then compared to like what I said on stage, it's much deeper. But I think it's from the perspective of it being a decade later. And the third one was, the essay about trying to and then stopping trying to learn to ski as an adult was with a previous agent. I had worked on that for what I was trying to do, sort of like a parenting essays, because my first book was a parenting essays book. We were trying to sell a second parenting essays book about older kids, like ages 7 to 14, middle-aged kids. And the feedback we got was that there was no, I had never heard this before, and I know this to be true, there's no comps for that. There's no shelf for that. Therefore, there's no other books like this. I'm like, right, that's why there's mine. And they're like, no, but if there's not another book that they can see it sitting next to, they don't want it. So that book never sold. I was able to reuse that essay, although that changed too, because what was the point? How did it fit into, I had to have a point for this book. And everything else was new.
Right, because this is a book written by someone who is a parent, but it is not a book about parenting.
I really tried hard on that. I mean, of course, the parenting kind of sneaks into it, because how can it not when you're writing a book about yourself? And it's certainly a big
part
of your identity.
It's a fundamental part of who you are.
Yes. And certainly a field where people pleasing and helping too much and whatever can come into play. But I really tried to make it a book that would have, I hoped, broader appeal. Mm-hmm. At least for women. Probably for women of all ages, but I decided women was a broad enough audience.
I think, you know, women buy most of the books.
We buy the books, that's right.
Truly. So I think it works. What else should we ask? Jenny, can you think of anything else that listeners want to know besides, oh my God, how can I sell my own book of essays?
Right.
We've probably slightly discouraged you from, but well, I hope we've given you some structural ideas.
I do have a question, which is unfair for our listeners, because this is not going to happen to you, but it did happen to Amy. So I think what's interesting about the question I'm going to ask, though, it relates to what we've been talking about, which is how do you shape material from your life into a cohesive whole for a book? But the question that I'm going to ask is, so I hope I'm getting the story right. I understand that you sold this book. This book came into being because you were at a party or a social event where you said something to someone who was in a position to say you should write that book and I will allow you to do so. Do I have that right?
That's right.
So you can tell that whole story. But the question I then have is, how do you go from an idea? So you have an idea. That's a thing a lot of people do have. I have this idea. How do you then make it into a book? That journey of shaping and visualizing and what makes a book? That's really the question I'm getting at. So can you tell us that story? Because I think that would be interesting.
Yes. So Zibby Owens, who everybody listening to this podcast, she's been on your show and she's a great lover and supporter of books. And she started a publishing company, Zibby Books. I ran into her at a party, was reintroduced to her, and she was just starting that company. And she said, and the person I was with said, well, Amy wrote a book. And I said, I did. And she said, what was it called? And I said, the book was called When Did I Get Like This? And she said, I read that book. I loved that book. And I said, oh, thank you very much. And she said, you should come on my podcast and talk about it. And I said, well, it came out more than 10 years ago. And she said, who cares? I don't care. I have people on my show. So she booked me on her podcast. We came on I did the interview with her. And during the interview, she said, you should write a book for me. And I really thought she was just saying it. And then when the interview was done, she's like, seriously, let's set up a time and I want you to pitch me some ideas. So there I was that weekend, like blowing the dust off everything, you know, like, what do I have around here that I can? And we had a great call where we bounced around some ideas. And I was assigned, basically, we talked about some different things. And she's like, what about this? I have this idea. Could you write a book about this? And the idea she pitched me was about slack and the different ways in your life that you have to give other people slack, give yourself slack, and pick up the slack. And I think there was a fourth column too. As women, can I work with that? I'm like, yes. And I did say, like, who knows where it'll go, but I'll start there. Yes. Okay, sure, yes. So I went off to start to write it, and then I was whiteboarding it from the, you know, very beginning, like, okay, times I have to give myself slack, give other people slack. Times I need to pick up the slack. In other words, times I needed to work harder than I did.
I'm guessing one column was a lot longer than the other.
Yes.
Column.
Yes. Well, one column was empty, no matter how hard I tried to think of those times that I didn't give it my all, that I really should have tried harder and stuck it out longer. There was nothing in that column. And that blank space was actually like, oh, that's what I have to write about. So I did kind of go back to them like, so I had this, I think it's really about this. And they were very much like, sure, sure, sure. And then it took me a year to write that first draft, I mean, a complete manuscript. Then it took about another year to edit it. And then it's taken months for it to come out because publishing is publishing. But that's how it started. And it wasn't like, I mean, it did feel like it fell out of the sky after books that I'd try to sell. It didn't work. But I had written the book and I had a body of work. And I guess I would just say, like, that's the lesson out of it. That be ready. What is that? Ina Garten has
luck
a new memoir.
Luck favors the prepared.
Yes, Luck Favors the Prepared, and like Anna Garten's book is either called that or I keep hearing this over and over again.
Ready for the luck or something.
Yeah,
like
be
that.
Ready for the luck.
I don't know if that's it, but It's something,
something
like that.
Something like that. Yeah. Yeah. So I was ready.
I'm reading it right now and I don't know the title.
I think that's, you know, no one, it's the Ina Garten book. So it's kind of like this did to some extent, you know, a little piece of luck dropped out of the sky, but like you said, you were ready for it, but also you were willing to put the work in. Like yeah. It didn't just, and I'm also intrigued that you did not feel slavishly obligated to stick to the idea that had been presented to you. How hard was it for you, oh people pleaser, to go back to them and say, please, sir, I yeah. have this better idea?
Yeah. I was glad that I had asked for permission ahead of time because I knew it was going to be, mm-hmm. even after spending like 3 days on this, like, okay, like I could write this book, but I think I'm going to work with this clay a little longer. And it's funny, I just was on Zibby's podcast as well. And she's like, I can't believe you wrote this book. And I'm like, you assigned it to me. And she's like, yeah, but people don't do it. They give lots of people ideas and you actually finished it. And that's the part of me. That's the happy to help. Like, wait, people say they're going to write a book and then flake? Like, no, I wouldn't know how.
I don't know who those people are either. Yeah. I don't think anyone listening to this podcast knows who those people
are. Right. So apparently there are those people, but we're not those people.
But I love this story of what you did when presented with this opportunity and seeing that blank column. Like that to me is a skill that you have that's shaped from all the work you've done as a actor and a playwright and a writer and a podcaster, the ability to see what the story is, to see that Venn diagram of where what you care about and what you want to do and write intersects with what could work. Do you, can you talk about that a little more?
I think it was the podcast, truly. So I've been doing What Fresh Hell for 8 years and my co-host Margaret Abels and I are great. We work together very well. We're very different. And from the very beginning, she was like, it's a funny podcast with some takeaways. I'm like, it's a chock full of takeaways podcast. That's also pretty funny. You know, we were like chocolate and peanut butter. And I was always insistent in my own mind that it be both, that we weren't just going to be like, my life is crazy, just like the book, that it was going to be, you were going to have learned something or gotten something out of having read it. You feel seen, but it also helps you. I like to help people. It wasn't just my crazy life and some crazy things that happened. And shaping the podcast that way and looking at, well, studies say that women are just better at multitaskers, or do they actually say that, or is that just what the magazine article about the study said? I learned to do all that from the podcast, and it doesn't take weeks in a library, right? It takes like 90 minutes on Google now to find these studies and download them and actually read them. And so I honed that skill, and I think the idea that it was going to be funny and useful, that everything I make is going to be funny and useful and make women feel better about themselves, that sort of became my North Star. And so then, yeah, I think all the time that I was trying to write books that didn't sell, including a novel, it was okay because it was all work that was making my writing better.
Well, I feel like this is sort of the ultimate meta, which is that you did not people please to write the book that you thought that somebody else wanted. And they were, as is sort of one of the points as you're in your book, they were fine with that.
Yeah.
And sometimes people aren't fine with that, but then you can stick to it. And
or they were, you know, I had big notes. I had a lot of rewrites to do, but they weren't incorrect. And they were generous enough to bring in a developmental editor because I'm unusual. They don't usually work with books sold on proposal. And so this mm-hmm. was a leap of faith for everybody. Right. So they brought in a really good editor who really worked with me. And like I said before, the rewrites required were extensive. And you know, when you get that letter and you're like, shoot, this is,
yes,
I have to do all this now. She's right. Yes, right. It's 11 pages of write, single spaced. And now I have to do it.
11 pages. That's a much better way to look at it than 11 pages of wrong. as in you're wrong, not
you're wrong. And my book is perfect. I mean, yeah. Of course, there's a little bit of that. And I think that a good editor, too, like, lets you do that, lets you gnash your teeth and cry out to the gods, and then you get to work.
Yeah.
What I love, though, is this story you told about reading the book for audio and thinking, wait, this works. This is pretty good. Because yeah. that, too, is the kind of sentiment that the person who you were writing this book about, that young girl, probably wouldn't have said, you know, the perfectionist that, oh, but I could have done it better, or but I could have, or but I still want to, or but wait. And the fact that you could read that and think that and feel that just seems like a massive triumph.
Yeah, I guess it is. Yeah, thank you. I'm really excited. I'm so excited this book is finally coming out, you know, that it's a long gestation period. A book, even though it's a delightful thing to get to do. It's a long wait. And so I'm excited that it's coming out finally.
All of that is true. All right. I think we've kind of hit our timing limit mm-hmm. here. Before we go, has anyone read anything particularly wonderful lately that they would like to share with readers?
Oh, me.
Listeners.
So I
always do that.
I am, in fact, reading the Ina Garten book, which is called Be Ready When the Luck Happens.
Okay.
And it's a memoir. And it is so charming. It is so charming. It's sort of just a story of her life and career and how she built all these things. And she came of age at a time when women didn't build things and make things and take these leaps of faith for the most part. And she's showing how she did that and kind of digging into her marriage. And I love a book about an entrepreneur and especially a woman entrepreneur. And I'm just finding it utterly charming.
That's such an interesting counterpoint to the Martha Stewart Netflix documentary. I haven't read this book, but everybody's like, oh, she's so in love with her husband and she's just so sweet and charming. And I mean, I think Martha Stewart is really... I hold her in high esteem, but she's not sweet and charming and in a long-term loving relationship.
Like, I don't think that she would consider. That's in fact, she might be more upset if you did call her charming.
Right.
I mean,
right.
I say the reason I say that it's charming is because it's painting a picture of a world that I don't think exists anymore. And it reminds me in some ways more of my mother's life than my own. You know, like there's, I mean, it's charming and sort of it's like, wow, that world is gone and she, thank goodness it's gone is the point, you know, like this, you will get married and your husband will take care of you and these are the things you will do. And she was like, yeah, no, I want to open a, you know, a restaurant. And yeah, no, I want to, I'm going to stay here while my husband goes to Tokyo for a year. And yeah, no, I'm going to risk it all to buy this other thing. Like she just was very bold, but within this context of a time when women weren't expect to be. And I just find her way of talking about it to be very charming. Yeah. What about you guys? What are you reading?
I'm reading right now a book by Judy Dench called Shakespeare, The Man Who Pays the Rent. And it was just one of those, like, happened to see it on the table at my local indie bookstore. And it was said Shakespeare and Judy Dench. How could I not buy it? And it is a really enjoyable Brendan O'Hay. It's in conversations with Brendan O'Hay, who I think really wrote the book. But she just goes play by play. And after, 60 years on the stage, there's no part she hasn't played three times. And so she can really be like, well, the thing about Rosalind is she's a seeker, isn't she? And it's very conversational, very lovely. And I love it in a very, it's kind of like another version of this podcast. Like you're reading it like, yes, I agree. I feel that way about Rosalind too. And even though she's one of the greatest Shakespearean actresses ever, her approach to the work is very humble and daily and direct. And well, let's just see what's here. And so I love that book.
I'm going to buy it right now.
That sounds like also the perfect gift for like the right the right person.
Right, for the person who likes Shakespeare in your life. Yeah, it's a good one.
And acting and I can see that. So I have been reading very slowly because it is the way it is intended to be read, Meditations for Mortals by Oliver Berkman. I know I'm not alone in reading this, just like Jenny is not alone in reading Ina Garten's memoir. So Oliver Berkman famously wrote a couple of years ago, I only remember the subtitle, which was Productivity for Mortals.
4,000 Weeks, I think it was called.
Thank you, 4,000 Weeks.
Yeah, I love that book.
Productivity for Mortals. And it was great. So Meditations for Mortals is like, it's basically a book of essays, but it's couched as sort of a four-week programmed. It's not really, he doesn't say it's a program because he's not into programs for changing mm-hmm. your life, but it's kind of structured that way. And there are, that would be 28 because it is not just week. I can do math.
Four times seven?
Apparently. Yeah, I'm really struggling.
That's 28.
Four times seven. That would be 28. I got it. Anyway, there are 28, three to four page thoughts expanded into, ways that you might want to sort of relax your pressure around yourself. So it kind of goes nicely with this, and I'm really enjoying it. And then at the same time, I'm reading Reasons Not to Worry, which, who doesn't need that?
We could use some of those,
This is a book, Barnes & Noble sort of highlighted this and put it on a bunch of tables, which is how I ended up with it. It's by an Australian woman who was exploring Stoicism. And, we had the whole series of bro Stoic books about 10 years ago. But so it's really nice to have it from a woman's perspective. It's very useful. It's not just, be Stoic in the face of pain at all. It's more trying not to bring more suffering into your life. Anyway, I'm definitely enjoying both of those. I guess we're in a nonfiction place.
Yeah, I guess so. I do like nonfiction. I read a lot of nonfiction.
Yeah, it's a different kind of, it's a different reader ask. And sometimes it's just what you're here for. All right, well, this was fantastic. Listeners, you can, of course, buy Amy Wilson's Happy to Help, Adventures of a People Pleaser. Anywhere books are sold, you could get the audiobook, which you now know is read by Amy. You could get the ebook. You could do just about anything. You could give this to a people pleaser in your life, I think without being offensive, which is sometimes the problem
right.
with books like that. I think, that it would work. And you could also listen to Amy more on the What Fresh Hell podcast. And there will be links for all of that in the show notes.
This was amazing. I'm so excited. This feels like a real rite of passage for me to be. The book finally came out and I got to be on AM Writing. I'm excited.
All right, Jenny, you want to take us out?
Oh, I was so stressed when you say this because it's your words. Okay, until next time, keep your butt in the chair and your head in the game.
The Hashtag AmWriting podcast is produced by Andrew Perella. Our intro music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and played by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their time and their creative output because everyone deserves to be paid for their work.
Pause. Stop.
Stop.
Thank you.